This is Border Patrol, a weekly conversation with the new music artists who are shaping our 21st century sonic landscape. Border Patrol comes to you from the Classical Music Initiative, which is a service of American Public Media. It's funded in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. My name is Glenn Zuckman. I'm a visual artist in Los Angeles. I'm joined by my co-hosts, multimedia percussionist Amy Knowles, who's also the executive director of the California Ear Unit, and composer Martin Herman, who's also the artistic director of Long Beach's Downtown Opera. Hi, Amy. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Glenn.
Hi, Amy.
On this Border Patrol program, we'll visit members of the young Trummer Flora Music Collective at the San Diego studio of collective member Hans Fjellestad, and we'll head into the hills above Valencia's California Institute of the Arts, where we'll settle into the studio of composer Stephen Mosco for a conversation with avant-garde masters James Tenney and Stephen Lucky Mosco. One of the seminal books on Southern California architecture, perhaps the seminal book on Southern California architecture, is Rainer Banham's Los Angeles, The Architecture of Four Ecologies. In the book, Banham considers the architecture of the beach, the freeways, the foothills, and the flatlands. In this past week, we've visited four artists or groups of artists in 4 days. We'll only be able to fit two of the conversations in this broadcast, but we actually made it out to four amazing zones, four amazing ecological niches of new music. On Wednesday, we went up to the Calabasas hilltop home of film composer and concert composer Don Davis. On Thursday, we ventured up into the hills beyond Valencia to visit avant-garde masters Lucky Mosco and James Tenney. On Friday, we crossed over to Los Feliz for a conversation with singer, composer, performance artist, visual artist, producer, yoga instructor, and hospice volunteer, Julie Adler. And on Saturday, we drove down to Bordertown, USA, San Diego, California, where we chatted with members of the composition, jazz, rock, improvisation collective, Trummer Flora. The film composer, the avant-garde master, the eclecticist, the collective. What an amazing week we had in this sort of whirlwind tour of four different modalities, four different ways of being a new musician here in the 21st century. And I'm just wondering what kind of sense you got from this. And
very excited about the quality of the work.
More excited than you expected to be?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful to really, first of all, to go into the composers' homes or studios and just get a sense of their space and where they live, and also to get inside their head a little bit.
You could say that we've moved from rugged, craggy, individualist composers who subscribe to this modernist idea of art making, Tenney and Mosco, to a very postmodern landscape in San Diego, which is all about embracing artistic parity among diverse cultures and bringing art and improvisation to the process as part of the collective. So it's a very, very interesting diversity of landscape you have in Southern California as represented by these artists.
And the collective Trummer Flora itself reflects that. I think that it's amazing that a place which many have thought of as a cultural wasteland, that there is actually a consortium of these highly experimental composer musicians from completely different backgrounds. They've come together from Canada, Chile, Japan, Germany, Michigan, and San Diego, to name a few. And I think that the music really reflects this too. Their classical, jazz, spoken word, electronic, instrumental influences all informing the creation of a very compelling music that is a reflection both of the melting pot and the border town.
Their name's pretty interesting. Do you want to talk about the word Trummer Flora?
Sure. It actually comes from a quote by two environmental artists, Helen and Newton Harrison. The quote is as follows. Trummer Flora, or rubble plants and trees, are a special phenomenon unique to heavily bombed urban areas. The bomb acts as a plow, mixing rubble fragments with the earth, which often contains seeds dormant for a century or more. These seeds come to light, and those that can live in this new and special earth grow and flourish.
Is that an apt description of the collective as well?
I would definitely say it is, because as we were talking about before, they're all about embracing diverse cultures and sort of a landscape of music making, which absolutely breaks the boundaries of...
It's great that you say landscape of music making. The CDs they've put out, both the collectives and the individual members' disc, boy, there sure are so many sonic sources on those things.
The field recordings.
Oh, I know. I mean, the palette is extraordinary because, as you say, it includes field recordings. It includes live processing of people playing acoustic instruments like saxophone, violins, pianos, or whatever. It involves found instruments homemade instruments. And all of this is brought together in a world that contrasts the rugged individualism, you could say, of a tinny with a more collective point of view, where music making is
that,
all
as you
about
said earlier,
the process. Yeah,
it's, I mean, the modern versus postmodern sort of distinction,
well,
maybe a little bit.
That's a distinction that I feel in the music and the output. So if you take the body of work of both groups, now certainly Tinny Moscow have been at it a lot longer than Tremor Floor. These are primarily emerging artists who have come together.
Yet there's definitely a lineage. And I think it goes all the way back, in the case of Jim Tenney, Lucky Moscow, and Tremor Flora, it goes all the way back to John Cage. Jim worked with John in the 60s. Lucky worked with John Cage through the 70s and 80s. And I'm hearing, in the case of Hans Fjellstad's music, samples of prepared piano. John Cage created the prepared piano. And you have young composers now using it, but in a totally new way, where they're recording and triggering it with an electronic keyboard. But you still have a sense that there's this line, there's this lineage that's there, whether or not the composers themselves are even aware of it anymore.
And I suspect that they probably are. It seems like they're pretty informed.
Whether very much
they
so.
Want to be. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, that was one of the things that was so striking about the conversation with the artists of Tremor Flora, is they are well-versed in critical theory, postmodern ideas of power. And, you know, this is one of the things that I find really interesting about them, is that in their improvisations, it's really more about making art as a process, not about the end product. And in that way, I think it's very relevant with what we're doing, because so much of the art that we hear on the radio, the art that we hear performed publicly in concert settings, are all about the product, about what will sell a ticket, what will bring subscribers in, and not so much about the process.
Well, we should probably head down to San Diego and give a listen to our conversation with Hans Fjellstad and Ellen Weller of Tremor Flora.
Rawhide.
This idea about improvised music where, you know, anything goes, or there's sort of sense of it that's kind of mysterious, which is great, but there's also quite a bit of scholarship that's built up behind it, and there's quite a bit of analysis of what's going on in interactive systems between man and machine, between players, between the player and the audience, between the player and the audience and the space, and to get introduced and kind of develop ideas around that has really kind of been central to evolving the way that I improvise. And, you know, I think I was drawn to improvisation because I think of the risk that's involved and the sense of adventure, but also the sense of community, like Ellen was talking about, the way that you can kind of just be on stage talking with other players and kind of form a community right there on the spot, oftentimes with players that you've just met, that you relate with on some sort of musical level or some sort of abstract level, but you don't really know each other intimately, but then you kind of play together. And those kinds of conversations, either inside or outside of the collective, have been extremely valuable.
You referred to the Critical Studies and Experimental Practices Department at UCSD.
Yes.
This is where you...
I completed my PhD there in Critical Studies.
Could you just talk... That's such a fascinating and wide-open area, it seems to me. Could you talk a little bit more about how all of these things sort of form an amalgam in your own musical experimentation, critical studies, technology, the idea of traditional performance skills, which is certainly part of what you both do?
I started doing my research on ethnic music, multiculturalism. I was fascinated by a city like San Diego that has an enormously diverse population. So I started working with some groups around town, and I started wondering, how do they afford this? And I got drawn into the entire world of public funding and the relationship of who gets music. And then I got sucked into things like the California Arts Council, Commission for Culture in San Diego, the NEA, and understanding, talking about social capital, but... cultural capital and economics drew me all into this world. I was asking a musician a percussionist, if he thinks about the fact that his kit comes from all over the world, and you have a conga, which is a sacred instrument in some traditions. You have Turkish cymbals. You have a Chinese cymbal, and you have other various things from around the world. Do you think about that when you play? And, well, he didn't. This particular percussionist didn't. And so for me, this whole critical studies, experimental practice really causes me to interrogate the music I hear, the things I see, and the people I play with. I'm looking for other kind of meaning in there than just pure sensual sonic experience.
So is it necessary to make those cultural linkages or to maintain them or to renew them?
Is it necessary? That's just my experience. Mm-hmm. Since I've been through this journey of the Critical Studies Experimental Practices program, I do this interrogation. I do that when I was in France and I went through the Palace of Versailles. I was not seeing so much the pictures, but thinking about the workers who had to produce that for no wages. And then I start thinking about, you know, who mined the gold that gilded all the extravagant lifestyle. So I do start thinking about that. I don't look at art just as a product anymore. I think of it as a social process.
And can those pictures still be beautiful? Or when you understand that whole price that was paid to create them, is there no beauty sort of left in those?
It makes them more beautiful.
Okay.
Because it wasn't just one person created them for one other person. There's this whole, it's like the whole concept of Becker's art world. The whole art production situation takes a whole society to produce. And I can see them contextually, and they have more meaning. We always view art or listen to music contextually because we are all in our own individual context. We just never step outside to look at that process and to ask ourselves, what am I bringing to this experience?
Perfect them at post-urban sub-frequencies from the street with intellect. Deconstruct future culture and kick back. Perfect a man. Post-urban sub-frequencies from the street with intellect. Deconstruct future culture and kick back. Perfect a man.
I think that the way that that ties together with a lot of the other stuff that we've been talking about is kind of interesting, and also to the geography of where we're actually at, because I think geography plays a big role.
My next question.
Well, in terms of giving up control or whatever, I see those kinds of different sites, whether you're talking about multiculturalism or interdisciplinary kind of art actions. You have these little sites where there's pressure and there's balance. And so you have this pressure and this problem of this balance between your individual identity and the collective identity and the collective action within an ensemble context, for example. You have these sites of pressure and balance between different cultural points of view, you know, or political or social kinds of aspects. At the place we're at, we have the San Ysidro border, where we have this extreme example of a very physical pressure point, a very physical geographic site that you can look at and see, okay, here's where, you know, a third world environment sort of slams up against one of the richest cities in the richest state and the richest country in the entire world. And what kind of pressures, you know, are you looking at there? What kind of flow can you look at? What kind of complex systems are happening, you know? And I think that when you look at those sites, there are problems where you have to improvise just to sort of solve the problem, just to survive. And I look at ensemble improvisation. I look at when I make films as well. When I do any kind of art or social action, I like to look at those places where there's pressure and those places where there's maybe conflict or some sort of site where there's a really potent place where there's a lot of flow and a lot of activity and a lot of things going on that no one person can really kind of figure out. And so that you're constantly trying to figure out this balance of, you know, where's my identity in here? How do I fit in? How does this work? And, oh, I'd never even thought of that. Now, you know, that just came in from this turntablist. Okay, well, man, okay, now how does that, you know, now where do I fit in that? And how does that fit in with what I'm doing? And you've got these moment-to-moment problems that you have to solve in some logical way through improvisation. That's where the scholarship comes in. That's where the analysis, the constant kind of, you know, it's not anything goes, you know, it's not just.
Well, actually, I was going to ask, can you have a flute and a turntable and an anything? I mean, can you improv with any other sound making person?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. yeah, you can slam anything you want together. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be interesting.
But that's a separate issue.
Right. And the end product, you know, I mean, relies on so many different things, you know, like we've talked about, you know, the interaction between the individuals that you're talking about and the space and the time and where you're at, the location and all that. But it's interesting to try those things. And I think if you were living in Madison, Wisconsin, you know, I mean, you can still find, you know, you can construct your own places of pressure and places where you need to find balance. You know, you can really make an effort to kind of bring certain things together. I don't think there's any one place that's like so homogenous that you can't construct some kind of interesting kind of cross-fertilization thing happening.
So if you look carefully, you'll always find some kind of gradient.
If that's something that excites you, and I think as experimentalists, as improvisers, as modern musicians, I don't, you know, even if you're into doing drum and bass, you know, in your basement, I mean, I think those are the kinds of things you're looking at. It's just in San Diego, we happen to have this huge thing that you can look at called the border, you know. We're sitting 15 minutes away, where it's a very easy example of some of the pressures and some of the ideas about flow and improvising. You know, if you spend any time in Tijuana, you know, outside of the Revolution Avenue, outside of the kind of Sin Tourism kind of area or whatever, I mean, you see that there are transactions going on in every single square inch of that city. You know, people are improvising and transacting and negotiating constantly. And when you improvise, it's a transaction. You're negotiating. You're negotiating with all of the different elements that are involved. And that's an exciting place to be. You know, it's much more exciting than, to me anyway, than maybe trying to recreate the recording that I made in a multi-track studio environment and trying to recreate that for,
so are those,
you know,
almost
an audience.
Sort of completely different kinds of experiences for you?
Well, I mean, they're related, but yeah, they're certainly different. I mean, you know, it's a different place for your head to be at. You know, I mean, you're concentrating
on, as opposed to like, you know, a rock band or a singer songwriter.
Exactly.
Where it's kind of like, okay, I've created this record,
right?
Now
and now I need to recreate
it.
This moment so that people can identify with it, so that then they can identify with my object and buy that object, and then I can continue to survive. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But it's not an exciting place to be, maybe for myself at least, or for others in the collective. You know, it's not really, you know, the place we want to be at.
Would you say then that the art that you make through this collective is political, that it addresses certain political issues, but maybe not overtly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this kind of musical expression, as a lot of, you know, different kind of postmodern kind of art actions, I mean, they're revolutionary acts, and they are by their nature anti-establishment. At whatever level that occurs, that's some sort of a threat. I mean, the establishment, the powers that be, are certainly never happy with that kind of act. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there's metaphorical and actual political power in this kind of stuff. And that also ties into the idea of, speaking of Tijuana, for example, it's very natural in an environment there for collective action to be a very ordinary kind of mode of getting things done and of organization and of kind of moving forward on various levels. And it's in some ways a bit of a subversive somehow concept here, you know. I mean, we've got the independent kind of maverick kind of cowboy poet mentality, you know, this kind of mythology around the individual spirit here, which is great. But this idea that you can have a collective and call it a collective, I mean, that does sort of have certain kind of connotations, right? And it's strange that it does in a lot of ways, you know. I mean, that's necessary to survival for people that have voices outside of the mainstream to contribute those voices into the culture. You know, I mean, you got to have this kind of collective action. So the Tromaflora collective by its nature is somewhat, you know, subversive, certainly political. and then the music itself, the expression that comes out of the individual and collective members, you know. So yeah, I mean, you can't avoid the political components of what's going on.
Music seems to me to be about so many things, you know, not just political confrontation, but also reconciliation.
Sure. Well, you asked about the political.
No, I know, yes, but I mean, it encompasses so many powerful concepts, both metaphorically and, as you say, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, I promised myself I wouldn't ask any techie, knob-turning type questions, but I can't resist because clearly a lot of what you do does explore the vanguard of developments in technology, and particularly in how technology interacts, how machine interacts with live performers. And I'm just curious, what do you think an instrument is now?
Well, I've always thought of instruments, and that will include machines, as conduits. And in fact, I consider myself then a conduit, especially when I'm in a group improvisation situation. It doesn't really matter what I use to make a sound, to produce sound. It ideally, as far as I'm concerned, should all be transparent. Although there are times when you want the mechanical nature or the physical presence of the instrument to be obvious. For instance, one of the things I do on flute is key clicks or something. That's acknowledging the very physical nature of the flute as opposed to the nature of music, which is very ethereal and non-physical. But it's still, for me, a conduit. And to me, it completely doesn't matter whether I'm turning knobs or pushing buttons or blowing into something or some interesting combination of all of those things.
And what might a flute key click sound like?
Oh, funny you should ask. Okay, well, and this is a particularly sticky, humid key click sunny day. So we usually think of the flute as being long types of connected sounds generated by wind, but there are all those other interesting kind of clacky sounds going on. And I can add wind types to that also. So on. So for me, twisting or turning a knob, whether it's electronic or not, is similar. But it opens up a whole new world. And it acknowledges the machine-like nature of our society. And it acknowledges the types of work everyone is doing that's changed, moving from production line, working with mechanical things, to working with information.
Software production line.
Exactly. So to use the technology to make sound completely mirrors what happens in society. And I think that's always been the case. Mechanical clocks and things were very big a couple centuries ago, and mechanical instruments, and then electronics.
Sure, you use the technology of your time.
Absolutely. You know. And extends, you know, to the audience, because now we have iPods, and artists will respond to that by creating work specifically for new audience interfaces.
Well, isn't there a new Grammy?
New audience interfaces, nice. Mm-hmm.
Isn't there a new Grammy category for ringtones or something? I thought I heard that on the radio. That, you know, so I mean, so now you can actually, there are artists that are designing music for cell phones.
Well, and look at video games. There's some,
you know,
actually
what's
fabulous.
So amazing about the cell phone is that it's, I mean, you could look at the cell phone and say, well, it's this pathetic screen and it's got no processing power and it's just pathetic in every way. Why do I even care? But what is amazing, of course, about the cell phone is that A, they're ubiquitous, but also they connect two human beings. I mean, it's a network of humans that you can do things with.
And well, it's the age of the network. I mean, that's really kind of what's behind the way that we interact and kind of live our lives. You know, is we're in an age of networking.
And people are defining themselves as individuals with their choice of ringtone. I mean, it's really become, it's a sonic signature for some people. And now it's, you know, we learned years ago that it crosses over into nature with the birds imitating the cell phones in Australia. that's an interesting. I'll pick up that study. It is fascinating. Well, you know, parrots and things, but they will imitate the sounds they hear. And .
Is there anything else we ought to do with that flute while we're here?
Oh, well, I was just working with a high school band yesterday, and I suddenly had this idea that I'm now going to be launching into a whole new career writing band music for high schools, seeing what they can do with experimental things, and they've been listening to my CD, and so I was hoping that
I've often wondered why so many of those repertoires are seemingly so narrow.
Because unlike the other art forms, visual, written, language, all of these things start in kindergarten. Children in the United States are encouraged to experiment and express themselves. We don't correct their spelling for a couple of years when they start to write. We don't ask them to draw accurate, realistic images. But when it comes to music, because music is so dangerous, as Hans was saying earlier, children's musical exploration is very tightly controlled. And so part of my mission here on Earth, of course, is to subvert that central control and hand it to the people who are truly creative, which often are people under the age of 20, although I'm hoping I still have a little bit of that left. Well, this I'll play a little head joint. The top, for those of you who don't know, the flute can be pulled apart, and the head joint actually is the simplest part. It's just a tube with two holes in it, one at the end and one in the middle.
You know, that's interesting. That's also the definition of a person, isn't it?
I'll let you ponder that.
Wow. Thank you. So what do you need the whole rest of the thing for?
Good question. I have to do those key clicks once in a while.
Oh, for the key clicks. There you go.
Well, I was inspired to do all those kinds of things, interacting with people like Hans and the other members of the collective, just trying to keep my head above water with this incredibly creative group of people. So they're greatly responsible.
小さな石を拾って持って帰ろう。
Hans Fjellstad and Ellen Weller, thanks for patrolling the borders of new music with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Border Patrol from the Classical Music Initiative, a service of American Public Media.